This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for today, Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can post your questions either in the chat room in the People Speak Radio Show on Paltalk. This is a very special show tonight. We're talking to our guest, Rebecca Roth, about her best-selling 9/11 book, talking about the research and taking the research world by storm. Her book is called Methodical Illusion. Hey, welcome to the show, Rebecca.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to join you.
It's fantastic. It certainly is. This book, Methodical Illusion, has been cleverly styled as a fiction novel that describes covering the actual events of 9/11. Did you initially want to write it as a research book or as a collection of your own airline hostess experiences?
You know, originally I started to write a novel just about life in the jet stream and what it was like to be a flight attendant. And it wasn't until I was looking on the internet, actually, if I wanted a Middle Eastern name for a gentleman that I was going to introduce to the book. And I Google searched the 19 hijackers from 9/11 and found a bunch of them were still alive out of a BBC article dated about the 23rd of September, 2001. I thought, how did that escape me? And I was like, what? And I just started researching. I put the novel on hold. And then when I spent a couple of years, just 20 hours a day, digging into every aspect of 9/11 I could find, went down every rabbit hole. And then once I gathered all that information, I just didn't know what to do with it. Not many people can do that kind of research. So I thought, well, maybe what I should do, and I thought might be safer, to just put this out in a novel and go ahead and wrap that novel I was going to start just so that people could kind of get an understanding of what it's like to be a flight attendant and the difference in different characters that flight attendants can be. I mean, I flew with people that were lawyers on their days off from flying and did very different jobs besides being a flight attendant. So we're a lot more than a pillow and a beverage. And so I just kind of thought, well, I'll just wrap these together. And I just cleverly wrapped the 9/11 information into a character named Max Hager. I call him the Truther's Truther. And it's delivered. My character is really much like I was, in cognitive dissonance. I just couldn't face looking into this when I was flying. And afterwards, even, I just didn't want to know. But she kind of is wrapped up into that, too, and is afraid to be called a truther or a pinhead or tinfoil hat wearer. And so I really, my target audience really is that person that maybe is just starting to wake up and wants to know what it would be like to go through the 9/11 experience as a flight attendant.
In your book, the main character, Vera Hansen, goes through a typical transformation of a paradigm shift in perception. Was this character based in any small way on your own journey into 9/11 truth?
Very much so. As a matter of fact, I at one point when I discovered where the planes were taken, how they were taken over, and the location of all four aircraft that day, it truly made me sick. I felt like someone had just kicked me right in the stomach. I was physically ill. I couldn't continue writing. I took a couple, 2-3 weeks, and I went back. And the first thing I did was I went back to that flight calculator that I teach the reader how to use this, so you can try to debunk this theory if you want to see how long it takes. I know people say the people were loaded into one aircraft and all of them were flown over the ocean or to Dallas or to Cleveland. But what they don't understand is if you have a load of passengers that are going from point A to point B and you take them to point C and tell them they're going to go to point D, they're not going to go. They're going to be angry that they spent their hard-earned money on a ticket that's not getting them from A to B. It would just not be easy to do that kind of corralling of 250 or so people that day. So I just I kind of looked at all of the theories that I'd seen put out by non-airline people and just thought, oh, no. And then what I did was I based everything basically on the phone calls and the information given on those phone calls to find them, find where they were taken.
One of the best parts of the book that really jumped out at me was your analysis of the Betty Ong phone call. Could you go into that a little bit more?
Yes, Betty Ong was the first flight attendant the two flight attendants that called out on the first flight, flight 11 from Boston to LA, they called out at the same time, and most of the phone calls on all three of the first flights came out at the same time, exact same minute, and there were two people from each flight that made these calls. And Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were the flight attendants, and Betty Ong first said what really grasped my attention was that he, as in one hijacker, and both the flight attendants referred to him as a he, had sprayed pepper spray or mace in the business class, and they couldn't breathe in business class. She said she was sitting in her jump seat at 3R, which is the very tail section of the aircraft. And yet I knew from experience that if anybody sprayed pepper spray or mace in a pressurized cabin, the entire aircraft would smell that and be suffering the effects. And certainly the hijackers would have been. And they were supposedly up there in the cockpit or in business class. They would have rendered themselves no longer to be effective hijackers. Let's just put it that way. And, she was on the phone. Both of the flight attendants were on the phone for 27 minutes. Neither one of them coughed or complained about the effects of said pepper spray or mace. And I realized right then and there that the aircraft was no longer pressurized. And that was about 20 minutes from Boston. And from then, she went on to again then say that he stood upstairs. And when I heard her say that, and these are in FBI documents that I got this transcript from, I knew that she was in a hangar on the ground, no longer pressurized, and probably not even in the cabin of the aircraft. She also said something else that really got to me, and she said, "We're the first," and they were the first of the four aircraft. And then I realized at that point that they were being told what to say, and they were being told of the scenario. And since my book came out, I've talked to lots of people from American and United Airlines that have knew the crew members, the pilots and the flight attendants personally, and we've basically concluded that the handlers on board, there weren't 19 Arab hijackers, but the handlers on board told the crew that they were part of a drill, and that's what they thought they were doing when they pulled them off the airplane to take them upstairs in a hangar and into two offices to make these phone calls. They were probably told that they were part of some sort of military drill. Remember, there was like a dozen military drills going on across the United States that day.
Yes.
And so once they were taken off the aircraft, most everybody that called out referenced some type of gas or pepper spray or mace or something like that. So more than likely, the two phone callers were taken off the aircraft. And we're kind of deducing, I don't have proof of this, but they needed to kill almost 100 people in 15 minutes. So we're thinking some type of more lethal gas was probably used when the aircraft door was shut. Once the door was shut, they were sealed in there.
Now, the standard operating procedures for an airline hostess is to call the FAA emergency hotline in the case of a hijacking and use certain code words. Did Betty Ong do that, or did she call the reservation ticket desk for American Airlines?
We actually don't. We're actually not supposed to phone anyone. We're supposed to communicate with the pilots only, and they are the ones who phone down to the ground through their radio frequencies. Yeah, because if you really had a serious hijacker on board, you wouldn't want to be caught with a telephone or a telephone receiver to your ear, because he would think naturally that you were talking to someone on the ground and you were about to foil the hijacking plan he had. So what you were really supposed to do was to sit down and not draw attention to yourself. Like, that means take your name and name tag and your wings off, cover your uniform with a blanket, pretend you're asleep, and just basically leave the one flight attendant with the hijacker. And if it isn't you, then you should sit down and not draw attention to yourself.
So the phone calls were,
first they were made to some weird places. And I've asked several of the American flight attendants too, would you have called, because to me that was a very weird thing. Calling reservations is a guarantee to be on hold for 20 or 30 minutes. That's not where you'd want to call. And if you thought you had limited time, if you thought, well, maybe I can get one call in and let somebody know, maybe from an air phone, you wouldn't call there because you'd be on hold. And she said they did not have a direct number to attach them right through, straight through. So she thought, always thought that was weird too, the people that I talked to. So,
wow.
Yeah, and that was kind of weird. Now, Amy Sweeney, on the other hand, Flight 11, she did call to a supervisor, and that was someone she had just checked in front of. So that makes a little bit more sense. But Amy Sweeney, she reported that the hijacker was a passenger in 9B. Oh. Later on, she changed her mind and said, no, I changed my mind. That wasn't 9B, it was 10B. And as I continued researching, I looked, and lo and behold, if 9B wasn't an actual highly trained assassin, an anti-hijacking specialist, and a hostage rescue specialist for a hijacking type of thing from a foreign government.
Can you mention which foreign government that was?
Yeah, I can. He was with the Israeli Defense Forces and a special operations unit called the Sayeret Matkal. I don't know how my Hebrew is there, but that's their special operations name, and they are highly trained assassins. And interestingly enough, I remember reading about some other Israelis that had been in town, and also that in the BBC studios on the morning of 9/11, Ehud Barak, and he was a prime minister at one point for Israel, and Bibi Netanyahu both are also of the Sayeret Matkal Special Forces. And that was something I didn't know until I researched who 9B was. So we're actually led to believe, an interesting thing about 9B, he was fluent in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. And when she called back, she said, no, the hijacker was in 10B. And the official story says there was two hijackers in row 10A and B, and that they were apparently speaking Arabic right behind his ear, less than 2 feet away, planning the new Pearl Harbor, the biggest attack on America since the 40s. And he apparently, for no reason, they jumped up, and on the way to the cockpit, they decided to stab him with a plastic box cutter and kill him. And I think anybody that's believing that story needs to slap themselves across the face and wake up.
So one thing I did notice in your book is how much in-depth information you have actually covered about the Israeli involvement in 9/11. How much of this information can you personally verify as being factual?
Well, it is pretty much all factual. I didn't make any of that stuff up. It's pretty easy to just Google search the corporations and the people that were involved. For example, there is a dual Israeli United States citizen named Rabbi Dov Zakheim. He was the comptroller of the United States Pentagon. He was under investigation for misplacing $2.3 trillion. He has some interesting connections to a couple other things involved during 9/11 as well. The flight termination system, which is how they took over the aircraft remotely. And that he was the CEO of the SPC Corporation that made the flight termination system. That's a system that we still use to this day to operate our drones around the world. He also had another company, a subsidiary of SPC called TriData. And TriData got the blueprints for both the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center after the 1993 bombing. And he had one more connection that's very interesting. He was with a consortium, a group of other people, that they refurbished commercial Boeing 767s and turned them into military refueling tankers and sold them to militaries around the world. So you think about the good Rabbi Dov Zakheim. If it weren't for him, 9/11 couldn't have happened.
That's right. And apparently he's onsold a lot of old F-15s to Israel at bargain basement prices after he worked for Systems Planning Corporation, a division of Boeing that developed the flight termination system. How did the airline industry cope with that when they introduced the flight termination system within the actual airplanes themselves?
Well, not every airline in the United States accepted those. Boeing sold them to the commercial airlines in the United States in the event, listen carefully, in the event of a hijacking, and the hijacker were to take control of the aircraft inside the cockpit, we could land the aircraft remotely. And at that point, the aircraft and the passengers and the crew would be liberated by some SWAT team, special forces unit, or some wherever they landed, whoever they could get there the soonest. So when I say this, in the event of a hijacking and the hijacker took over the cockpit, we had that happen on 4 aircraft that day. And yet the flight termination system, or as American called it, the flight interruption system, was not used by anyone on the ground to remotely land the aircraft because it was already in use. And that's how they took over the aircraft.
So this guy in seat 9B is being known as Daniel Lewin, who was working for the Sayert Mercal, the special anti-hijacking airline division of the IDF. He was also the CEO of Akamai.net. Do you know much about that company?
Not a whole lot, other than what I read in the FBI papers about that. There was quite an interesting report about both him and his wife in the FBI report that I found from the Zachariah Moussaoui and the 9/11 commission hearings as well. Details like that. He was worth multiple millions, and he owned that company. And it was a communications internet type of company. That's all I know about.
But he could apparently kill a person with what was it, a ballpoint pen?
Yes, interesting. You know, his friends, and now he's quite a hero in Israel, because, you know, he was, we are led to believe that he was actually killed by a box cutter by those two hijackers they claimed were sitting behind him. But he his friends all said that he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card. And he was traveling on business, so I'm sure he had both of those in his hand. Like I said, he was able to understand. He was fluent in Arabic, and so if you've ever sat on an airplane, you know how easy it is to accidentally overhear the conversation going on right behind you, because it's not, you know, barely 2 feet away from your ears, and usually the people are sitting facing forward, and so they're kind of talking right in your direction. So, and there's nothing in the official story that says that he fought them or he heard them and fought back or whatever. But if he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card, and he was a highly trained assassin, it's really a stretch of your imagination to believe that he was actually killed by a plastic box cutter.
Now, Ms. Rebecca Roth, we actually have a caller on the line. I'm about to introduce him. We have Mr. Rock Cash. He has a question. Go ahead, Rock.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you, first of all?
Good. Great. Thanks.
Rebecca, would you happen to have any clues what happened to the two missing drones that disappeared in June of 2001? Now, were they also stolen by the Israelis, or that person that's in the within the administration that was able to get to those things, the Global Hawk drones and the other plans of the assassination on the 9/11 attack?
You know, I don't really know who took those drones, but one thing I did find is that most of the signers of the Project for New American Century that were actually calling for a quote-unquote new Pearl Harbor, of those signers, we have Wolfowitz, Feith, and Perlman. And they were all considered co-conspirators in the Jonathan Pollard spying trial, the Israeli who spied against the United States, who I think is still in prison here. I know they're trying to get him out every opportunity they can get, and using that as a wedge. There were so many of these people involved with our military and our Pentagon, it will blow your mind to dig in and find those. My dear friend Barbara Honegger, I had a long chat with her about what potentially hit the Pentagon, and it's probably one of those Global Hawks was one of the things that hit into the Pentagon. Who did it? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that was always my theory, that a missile hit first, and then a Global Hawk was made to look like an American Airlines plane in order to hit it. It was actually painted to look like an American Airlines with the American Airlines symbol on it. Anyways, yeah, well, you've got a lot more going on, so go ahead and finish the interview. A lot of good stuff. I'll have to get your book.
Thank you.
Now, Ms. Rebecca Roth, apparently it's taken 2 years ago when you finished the majority of this book, but why has it taken so long to finally publish it?
Well, you know, when I first discovered what I discovered, where how this was done and how it was covered up and the involvement of the American corporations and the agencies that we were led to believe were there to investigate and protect us, it was mind-blowing to me. And quite frankly, I didn't think anybody would want to read it. I thought people would hate me. I talked my publisher into doing an autographed book thing with me, and I just recently did a Coast to Coast AM, and literally the book sales went absolutely skyrocketed well into the top 20 on Amazon out of 8 million books. And I have been inundated with people that have contacted me, and you know, not just the 30 to 40 year people that I thought would be interested in this, but these are people that are 55 and older, up into their late 80s, that are joining in the truth movement in a huge way. So it's, I just really didn't think anyone would be interested to read it, and I thought people would hate me for what I discovered. And then when I this year at the anniversary, having had that book in the manuscript sitting there, and it was on a flash drive too in a Word document, I talked with a New York firefighter for a long period of time one day, the week of the anniversary, September 1st of September this year, and I got off the phone with him, and I just felt compelled to put it out there. And I honestly cannot explain what this force is, but the reception that the book has received has been phenomenal, that people have just coming forward thanking me for speaking out. Airline people are just buying the book by the caseload at a great discount straight from the publisher. I'm working, trying to get this a second edition. Now, people want to buy, read the second edition. It's in the Kindle form right now, but I can't get the printer to switch it out until printing stops. And there's so many people buying this book that I can't switch out the book part into the second edition. In the second edition, basically the only thing that's changed are endorsements. And the foreword has been written by a United Airlines Boeing 767 captain, now retired.
Yes, ma'am, because I tried to buy the book myself from Amazon, and apparently it's out of stock, but I simply don't believe that. So I had to settle for the Kindle. However, if people do want to buy Ms. Rebecca Roth's book called Methodical Illusion, you can go to methodicalillusion.com, and you can place your order directly. Is that not true?
Yes, you can get an autographed book. It's $20 in the United States. It's $30 US and for any international. And it's just, it costs that much to send it, especially down under to New Zealand and Australia. But most of the European ones are, that's how much the postage changed for us. And it's $30 US. You can either, you can do one of two things. You can either email me all of your payment information, your shipping information, fill it out there. Some people, we don't have a store or anything. I mean, I just had no idea this was going to happen.
Right.
But it goes directly to my personal email. So any of the comments that you put on, contact us, or any of those orders go right to me. If you're an United States phone number, my publisher will phone you and take your information over the phone. But yes, we are getting books, and Amazon did that last time the book went into the well into the top 100. They put temporarily out of stock, but that's not true. And I've talked to people that ordered the book, and it has now been shipped to them in 3 days. So you can order the book on that way. If you're really in a hurry, the Kindle is a great way to do it. And if you don't have a Kindle, you can just download a free app to read it on any computer and almost any smartphone and stuff. So it's very handy. It's very cool.
Fantastic.
And you can make the print larger too. Somebody asked me about if we had a, you know, a copy with large print. Well, that would be what I would, you know, just suggest you do, because, you know, every time you publish a book, you've got to set up all this formatting and the size of the print, all that stuff. In paper, it's really hard to do. So the Kindle makes that really easy. You can just click on and make your font the size that's easy for you to read.
And it's just an easy download for $8 from Amazon.
That's right. It's $9.11 US. So, I know it switches out a little bit into Europe. And, you know, another thing that amazed me is as soon as the book came out in the middle of November, I had people from all over the world getting this book. We just took orders for, I think, 5 different countries in the last 2 days. So I'm going to get a map and put a little pin into every country, because it's just amazing to me. I pinch myself, because like I said, I thought nobody would want to read it, or maybe 20 people would read it. My publisher's ready to shoot me. I actually had to answer phones today and make phone calls to fill orders, because, I mean, he's just overwhelmed.
We do have a couple of questions from our beloved guests in the Pal Talk chat room. We have a Mr. Donald Rumsfeld from Washington with his question to Rebecca. Have you read Kevin Ryan's book or read any of his investigations about the 9/11 events?
No, I haven't.
Okay. We have a question from Clifford, Houston, Texas. What do you think about the 28 classified pages of the Senate's 9/11 report?
I think they're a diversion, because I don't really think the royal Saudi family had much to do with this. I didn't find many Saudis in my research.
So you don't believe the official conspiracy theory of 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters?
Well, I found that 10 of them are still alive, and people that are much deeper into intelligence work than my little research took me basically are saying that the other 9 were more than likely just exactly what I started out to do myself, and that was just to create, use a first name from one and a last name from the other, and they were just complete made-up people.
What about Mohammed Attar? Is he well known within the flight industry?
Mohammed Attar, what a great story. After the book came out and it was read by some American pursers, I got a phone call and email said, you got to call me. And so I had a nice phone chat with a gal who'd been flying about 30 years as a purser for American. And she told me an interesting story. She was stuck in Tokyo at the time of 9/11. And at the same hotel that United Airlines stays at, just coincidentally, they just happened to stay in the same hotel there. And so every day after 9/11, since they were stuck there, they would have a briefing by someone from the executive offices of United Airlines. And when they told the group of American and United pilots and flight attendants that were stuck there in Tokyo because they couldn't fly back to the States, that the ringleader was Mohammed Atta, they absolutely freaked out. She said every senior flight attendant at American knew Mohammed Atta. He was an executive platinum million-mile passenger with American for two to 3 years prior to 9/11. Yes.
So he was well-known within the flight industry, within the hostesses, within the people who worked in the industry.
That's correct. And for those that don't know this, just so you do know, if you're a million-mile person, we that are senior enough to hold first class all the time, we know who you are and we recognize you after we've had you on for a time or maybe two. We will know you if we see you in the terminal in a restaurant or in a shop or something. We'll know you by first and last name because you are a million-mile passenger, and we all know who you are. And so we become very familiar with those passengers because they do fly so often. You do recognize them by their face. And so I know that happened with me several times, and I could be walking down a terminal somewhere and see one of the people that happened to fly to one of my routes often that I knew was a million mile customer. So we always use your first and last name, and we know who you are. So yeah, everybody was just shocked. She said they still can't believe it. It's kind of wild.
Hypothetically speaking, prior to 9/11, if Mohammed Attar got on a flight from Boston to Los Angeles, he would get the Silver Star treatment on any flight. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. And if he were in business class, he would be moved to first class if there was a three-class setup on the aircraft. Yeah, he definitely would.
Wow. What are your thoughts on the 9/11 Commission? Do you think they covered most of the aspects of the 9/11 event?
No, they didn't cover a lot of things. As a matter of fact, they left a lot of things out. Building 7 was completely left out. It fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon, and a lot of people don't even know that the third skyscraper fell down that day. It was a 47-story building. It fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon, having not been hit by an aircraft, and there is no explanation for that, and it was not included in their report. Neither was Barbara Olson's telephone calls.
About the telephone calls, can you tell us a little bit more about why they were fabricated and how it was impossible to make those calls back in those days? I mean, you have first-hand experience.
I don't believe they were fabricated, but I do believe this, that each aircraft that was remotely taken to the location that I expose in the book, two people were taken off the aircraft, and they were brought into a room, and that's why they were making these phone calls. And that's why Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney, the two flight attendants, were saying two different things. Amy Sweeney said they were sitting in the second to the last row and coach together. But Betty Ong said she was sitting in 3R, the jump seat. One of them said there was a doctor tending to the passenger in 9B that had been stabbed. The other one said there was no doctor or nurse or medical personnel on board. Now, here's another thing that's interesting. Amy Sweeney, when she was asked about 1 minute before impact to the North Tower, supposedly, could she tell where she was? She'd been flying, I believe, 13 years, 12 or 13 years. She supposedly looks out the window, and she says, I see buildings, I see water, oh no. And then they lose the phone call, right? It's the supposed crash time. there isn't a flight attendant flying that's flown into New York one time that doesn't know she's in New York the second time she's there. If you look out the window 1 minute before you're crashing into the North Tower, you were a flight attendant or even a passenger, you would say, "I'm over New York. I'm over Manhattan. This is New York, New York." There's only one New York, New York, and it's very obvious when you look out the window. You're not somewhere else, and that's what you would say. You'd say you're over New York.
Now, we here on the BBS radio network reach out across the world, in fact, in live, real time. We actually have a caller from Washington, D.C., who goes by the name of Donald Rumsfeld himself. Donald, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me? Fine.
Good. Yes, hi, Rebecca. It's great to hear your voice and talking about this. Did I read somewhere that you had doing research or something on 9/11 Blogger? And I have a follow-up question to that.
No, I am not on any Facebook groups or internet groups or blogs or anything else, no. Someone might be talking about me. No, mm-mm.
Oh, okay. Have you read any of David Ray Griffin's work prior to this?
No, I haven't.
Oh, do you know who David Ray Griffin is?
I do.
Oh, okay, good. All right. I'm looking forward to reading your book on a PDF free of charge rather than getting this kind of vital information to the world. Should be free, and I understand the need to write a book, but... do you have any plans to release this as a free PDF at some point?
No, I don't.
Why is that?
Because it's a novel, and that's how I wrote it, and that's how I'm selling it. I'm not giving it away as a PDF. It's on a Kindle if you'd like to read it on a computer. $9.11 is not a fraction. Not even a penny, fraction of a penny for all of the hours of research I put into this.
Well, I'm
so I don't feel bad about charging for it. No, I don't. Call me a capitalist, I guess, if that's where you're going with this. But no, I don't have any plans to make it in a PDF free at this point.
All right. I just felt that some of the information that you have is pretty vital to the security, and it's good for the United States. And good for the people, really, all around the world. I think it should be free. I'll get off the line to hear the rebuttal on that one.
Well, I can certainly recommend the book, Donald. I've read the Kindle myself, and I guarantee it's worth every penny of $9 if you want to buy the Kindle. I'm certainly going to buy the book when it becomes available. The second print is out now, and you can get it from methodicalillusion.com. Or wait, like I'm doing, to get it from Amazon, or get a signed copy from Rebecca herself. I'm certainly looking forward to that. Have you spoken to any other 9/11 truthers apart from Kevin Barrett? I heard your interview with him, which was fantastic, by the way. Have you spoken to maybe Richard Gage or any of the architects and engineers?
I have, actually. I've been invited to speak to their group, and I've done several conference calls because they just wanted to know what I'd found. Several of them have read the book. Several truth groups I've done Skype interviews with on video so that I can do a presentation, and then they buy the book by the bulk, by a box of 24 or 48, and they can share them. And if they buy them at $10 a book and sell them at retail at $16.95, that's fine with me. I don't care if they want to make the money. And then there's a lot of truth groups out there that are pounding the streets and handing out brochures, and those things aren't free. And so if they buy a book for $10.60 and turn around and sell it for $16 or $17, they can keep the profit and, you know, turn that money into their costs for printing brochures, because that's what they do. I don't care how much they charge or they can give it away. I have United and American pilots buying them by the case, giving them away.
Wow.
They're that sure of what I discovered. Now, I know this guy that he doesn't want to spend money on a novel, and it's unfortunate that people are so caught up in this. And I found this is a very strange thing with the truth movement. That I don't know, these people are like anti-money or something, but, if I were Well, let me just say this. I'm currently working on research right now that I won't charge for if it comes out to be what it is appearing to be at this point. But I'm still working with some researchers, and Steve knows some of them very well, that if we come out with some stuff that is going to be, a national security issue. My novel isn't a national security issue. It isn't something that's going to save the world. It's just a very great, entertaining book with a lot of truth wrapped into it. And so,
it certainly is. Yes, yes. Well, this is the People Speak Radio. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with special guest Rebecca Roth. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions again after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host for today, Steve Johnson. We're back with our guest tonight, the author of Methodical Illusion, Rebecca Roth. Her book, her novel, is called Methodical Illusion. That's the name of it. It's available on Amazon.com, currently as a Kindle, or from her website, methodicalillusion.com. Now, one of the interesting questions I have that hasn't been answered yet, Ms. Roth, is why did the pilots not press the hijacker button? Why did they not press that almighty red button that says, we're under attack? Why didn't that happen?
That's often referred to as squawking 7500. That's a frequency that it indicates to other aircraft and everyone on the ground, air traffic control, that you have been hijacked. And so you'll hear that referred to as squawking 7500. It's a frequency. It's very easy to do. And the reason I'm assuming that they didn't do that is that no one would have believed in a million years that the flight termination system that was sold to be used in the event that a hijacker were in the cockpit would actually be used. It kind of reminds me of that 2001 Space Odyssey where HAL, the computer, takes over the spaceship. You would never have dreamed that because it was designed and sold. Some pilots didn't even know it was on board because it was, you know, sold to the airlines in the event that a hijacker took control. And if there isn't a hijacker in the cockpit, you would never dream that that thing would be taking control. I think what happened, and I know that in some of the transcripts I found through the Freedom of Information Act data that I have, that some of the air traffic controllers thought they were having, in fact, a mechanical that was affecting their radio. And it would be basically like that to the pilots as well. Once the flight termination system takes over, it overrides the transponder frequency. So the air traffic controllers can no longer see them on radar. And they also lose all radio frequency communication, and they lose communication with the cabin crew in the back as well. And you'll remember Betty Ong also said, the pilots aren't answering their phone. We can't communicate with the pilots. We can't call the pilots. And that was another key indicator to me, because when they introduced this in the 90s and sold it to some airlines, the Airline Pilot Association was not happy about it. The pilots didn't want it because having communication is vital in a hijacking situation, because the name of the game for us is to get you, the passengers, down to the ground. And so to do that, sometimes we want to coordinate with the SWAT team. We want, if it's going to take them 15 minutes to get there, we need to know, the pilots will need to know that, and we need to know what airport they're going to. They need to have that communication. It's vitally important for us. So if we're in the back and we see there's a, you know, the guy's got a gun or the guy's got a box cutter or whatever, we tell the pilot tells the ground, they don't want to lose that communication, and that's what the flight termination system did.
I see. In your 30 years as a flight attendant, in all the jobs that you've done, why is it not believable when Betty Ong says, I think there's a hijacking? Why is that not believable?
Well, because if there's a hijacking, first off, she said also, we're in the air, and you don't need to explain where you are in a hijacking. Hijackings only take place in the air. And that was another weird thing that I found a lot of passengers even said was, we're in the air, as very much like a scripted conversation. Middle Eastern descent, they described the hijackers as Middle Eastern descent. People don't talk like that. That's just not a terminology we'd use, because, I mean, I just don't think I could even point somebody out and say they were... Oh, I have a neighbor that's a Saudi Arabian. I couldn't tell what he was. He could have been a Mexican for all I know. I didn't know what he was. And so, you know, it's just impossible. It's this crazy terminology. But what I was finding is that everybody was using that crazy terminology. So then I started to see that it was very scripted. And the fact that she said, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked. If you're being hijacked, there's a hijacker on board. He's usually standing in the aisle. He's usually got a flight attendant in some sort of hostage situation. And you know it. There's no doubt about it. You go immediately into your training. And that's another thing we're led to believe, that the flight attendants on Flight 93, that they allowed the passengers, the let's roll guys, to take hot water and cough pots of hot water into the cockpit and take over a hostage or a hijacking situation. That's one of the things we train for, and we're in control. We're always in control. And if you doubt that the next time you're on a flight, go try to take control. See what the flight attendant's going to do. But we train for that. We have code words. We have specific things we do and don't do and say and don't say. And there's no way that we would give control in a hijack situation to any untrained passengers. So that was another thing that I saw was really weird. Not only did this flight attendant not know what was happening, but she, you know, if they were hijacked or not, she thought they might be. But I mean, there's no doubt in your mind you're hijacked. It's kind of like when you say you've got CPR in progress. It is or it isn't.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned earlier about the passengers being taken off the plane to a certain location. I'm not going to give it too much away because I've already read the book. Now, is it true or not that you were contacted by actual people who were working at that location that confirmed your story?
Yes, I have been, and I'm hoping that every time I do an interview, somebody else comes forward. That's very true. The location was evacuated, and all of the people that were brought up as active duty military to report to that area were locked out for 2 to 3 days afterwards. Now they know why.
Although the majority of your book revolves around the procedures in airline hijacking situations, you also mention about the Pentagon. Why was it so important that that specific location in the Pentagon East Wing was actually hit? What was in that location?
Well, at the Pentagon and also Building 7, there's some interesting things going on. There were evidence and investigations were going on at the Office of Naval Intelligence in the Pentagon, as well as the Army Auditors, where for two separate offices, both of which were hit pretty hard by explosives. And they were investigating the missing $2.3 trillion. They were also investigating Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing cases, which were actually due to go into court, I believe, in October that year. And most of their evidence was at Building 7.
So the places that were attacked in Building 7 and at the Pentagon were the places that had all the documents and had all the proof and all the evidence of the missing $2.3 trillion. Is that your assertion?
That's correct.
Goodness. What was your first reaction when you learned about the missing gold bars underneath WTC-4 and WTC-6? What was your first reaction?
Well, I just couldn't believe all of this stuff. I mean, I was just mind blown every time I'd find something like the Brady Bonds, $240 billion worth of fraudulent gold bonds and stolen gold from when Bush Sr. Basically financially collapsed the old Soviet Union. And some of it was from the Philippines stolen gold that he had accumulated and stolen. And they needed to launder that gold back into a very heavily monitored gold market at that time. And so you'll remember one of the things that happened immediately on 9/11 was the SEC went into emergency mode, and it stayed there for 2 weeks until that the physical gold that they had involved with these or associated with these Brady bonds was actually laundered back into the system.
Which aspect of 9/11 really blew you away the most?
I think where the planes and the passengers were taken to discover that was, I mean, that was my quest because nobody had ever, I mean, people had said no plane hit Shanksville, no plane hit Pentagon. I could see that myself. I didn't know what hit buildings, the South Tower, Building 2, and I couldn't tell what that was that hit the North Tower after I saw the Naudette brothers. It looked smaller than a 767, and it looked like it was going much faster than a 76 could go at that level above sea level. I mean, it was only 1,000 feet. You can't go that fast in an aircraft that size at that low altitude because the air is too heavy. It's just not going to happen. They were claiming basically that the aircraft were going faster than they were designed to go at cruise altitude of 35,000 feet. So in a plane that size, you would be able to focus on it, and you can't even slow down that Naudette brothers video slow enough to see what that was. So I was very suspicious of that. The 767 that hit the South Tower, it obviously has something else on the belly of the fuselage that's not normal. And you can talk to any airline pilot, and I talk to a lot of them, especially from American and United, and they're all in agreement. And one of the things the pilots ask me is, have I figured out how they got that plane to slice through that steel building like a hot knife through butter? Because that, as an airline employee, as an airline professional, we study crashes every year. Flight attendants and pilots, it's an impossibility what we saw. And I don't have an explanation for that. I'm like, maybe it was computer graphics. I don't know. I'm not qualified. I don't know that much about the technology. It could have been a hologram. I don't know what it was. But I know one thing, a 767 cannot do that. At that altitude, at the speed it was going, it absolutely was impossible. And that's what I saw from the very get-go. But then I woke up actually to a phone call and turn the television on just enough time to see that plane actually disappear into a little poof of smoke into the building. Mm-hmm. I thought it was trick photography. I thought it was a joke.
How has the airline industry reacted to your book? Have you had a lot of support from them?
I have had tons of support from flight attendants and some executive vice presidents as well, and pilots, yes.
What about opposing views? Have you had anybody who's written to you who has either threatened you or made you feel insecure or unsafe?
No, I have not. And I also have not had anybody come forward and say, what you claimed is impossible, and here's why. I tried to debunk myself for over a month. You can ask my husband. I went through this over and over and over again because cell phones did not work at altitude. And by the way, American Airlines did not have a functioning airphone on their Boeing 757s, which is what Flight 77 supposedly into the Pentagon was after January 31st, 2001. So we know Barbara Olson called from her cell phone. And we know she had to be on the ground to do that. And all the flight times from Newark, Dulles, and Boston all worked to that location perfectly. Those calls were made shortly after. That location also offers five or six very large hangars that are large enough for a C-5 transport aircraft, which is larger than a 747.
Why was it not possible to make a phone call from the mobile? I mean, have you ever tried that yourself, being a flight attendant?
Oh, yes. And any flight attendant or pilot will tell you that above about 1,800 feet, even still to this day, a couple years ago, I flew. It was the last time I'll ever get in an airplane because of the treatment by the TSA and all of that stuff that we have to go through to get into an airplane. If I can't drive there, I won't go there now. But yes, we've tried it many, many, many times. As a matter of fact, I've stood in the tail section of a 757 with a bunch of crew members. We all had different cell phone companies, and we were comparing who's got bars, who doesn't. The aircraft itself acts somewhat like a Faraday cage, and nowadays you'll see that with the new smartphones and stuff that have 4G, and they can connect on, and you can talk on your phone to some of them now, but that's very recent. In 2001, the cell phone technology absolutely wasn't, you weren't able to hold a cell at all unless you were maybe right real close to the ground for just a second or two. But no, it's impossible. Sorry.
Was there any points in your book that you had to go over and reread or maybe take out of the book that you weren't sure about?
No.
So everything that you put in there is everything you've researched and everything that you believe to this day?
Yeah, I can't think of anything that's not true. It's not real. I mean, okay. I mean, there is a novel aspect to it. I mean, there's a couple of crash sites that were just completely part of the novel to keep you turning pages and get you to understand what an airline really does in an accident. That's why I put all that character building stuff in those first few chapters.
Do you have any extra information that you weren't able to put in the book?
I have some that I'm currently working on, but I'm still not at a position where I can talk about it. But as soon as I do, I'm going to book another show with you because I will not wait till it comes out in a sequel. I will put that out in public. And we are on the verge of pretty much figuring out exactly what we actually are looking at. So it's close. We'll definitely have another interview, and we'll announce it because I'll go on every channel and do it.
Awesome. And you have had a lot of people actually give you information since you put your book out. Is that not correct?
That's correct. I have a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act information that I'm going through, and lots of people coming forward, and everyone from people that were working with metal that told me that they saw liquid metal and that they heard that metal was reported to be liquid underneath the buildings, etc. They know the temperature that it has to happen at, and lots of explosives people, and it's unbelievable. Lots of airline people, too.
Will, if you ever write a sequel, will it cover the actual implosion or demolition of the towers?
You know, I've got my sequel is it's growing in my mind, and I've got some notes going on it. I'm really following up on the people that I believe were the handlers and where everybody went to work when they left, like Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, and the hijack coordinator that left for town for the day. And it's real interesting, all of the corporate connections all of those people have and the new data that I'm looking into as well. So go into the explosives more. I mean, I know there are technologies that we aren't even aware of that were used. Mm. I have some scientists that are trying to tell me, but they have to be careful. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You've been listening to the... Sorry, ma'am. You've been listening to the Speak Radio with your host, Steve Johnson. I'd like to thank you, Miss Rebecca Roth, and I'd like to thank everybody for listening in and remind you to visit her website at methodicalillusion.com. Join us next week on the People Speak Radio Show when we continue with part two of Rebecca Roth talking more about her fascinating book, Methodical Illusion. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Hey, thank you, Steve. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, take care and bye for now.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.